The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Shuad Kutin, with me Kusu Chuang, and this is The Breakfast Grill. Our guest this morning, Dato' Ambika Srinivasan, lawyer and former chairperson of Bersih, the electoral reform movement. She needs no introduction. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here, Ambika.
Good morning. Thank you.
I want to begin with the front page of The Sun this morning. It's shake up. It's all about people leaving or being vacated out of their positions in government. But above there, that story is this headline: Bar Council proposes Ambika as Attorney General. General, that's you. And what do you think of the many voices in the public, as well as from institutions like the Bar Council, which you used to head, saying that you would be the best choice for Attorney General?
You had to start with a tough question there, Sharad. Well, you know what? It's flattering. It's humbling. There are also others who have asked for me to be chairperson of to lead the EC Commission, MACC, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, actually, it's a little bit premature to go into this issue. What I can tell you is that my personal interest is to look into the reform of all the institutions. And I'll have to just leave it at that.
Okay, what about? So what do you think is behind these calls? Is it a desire for a trustworthy, a figure who represents trust? So, you know, because the trust deficit was something that was widening, you know, every day under the previous administration.
I think there's no doubt that, and of course, my name's not the only one out there. There's no doubt that the office of the Attorney General is going to be one of the most important. And it is because of the trust deficit that I don't think the Malaysian people can go through an era of having an Attorney General whom they cannot trust, whom they see as entirely pro-government, and who acts only in the interest of the government. And I think we are past that. So it is critical that the person who's appointed is independent and, of course, of impeccable integrity. And that's why these suggestions are being made, I think.
Well, first of all, that role, Ambika, also has to see the divorce of the twin directions where he's also the lead, well, he or she will be the legal advisor to the government, as well as being the director of public prosecutions. You know, in your mind, which are the top institutions that need really relooking at other than the Attorney General? Which other institutions need instant examination and reform?
Well, there are so many. You have, of course, the Election Commission. That would be my one of my favourites that require revamping, given what they did in the last general elections. Then, of course, we have to look at the judiciary. As you say, AGs, chambers, and the splitting of the Attorney General's role and the public prosecutor's role. You have to look at the MACC, Parliament. Parliament requires reform. Police. And then, of course, you have to look at the media and how, as an institution, and how we can improve things for the media.
You know, political parties in opposition often set a very high bar for governance because, in some sense, they feel that the institutions, the structures are being used against them. Now, when they come to power, it's a very different order because then they would perhaps see those structures as enabling for them, right? So the question is, do you think this particular government, the Pakatan Harapan government led by Tun Dr. Mahathir, has a political will to actually in some ways disadvantage themselves, take away the unlevel playing field that will actually put them on par with their rivals?
Well, I see the political will in their manifesto and from what they have been saying so far. Look, they're talking about the rule of law. When you talk about the rule of law, you're also talking about checks and balances. And with checks and balances, that's where you will bring things back into, you will actually be seeing democracy reviving, okay? And so I see them having the political will. The minute they stop having the political will, we will all be reminding them because it is not disadvantageous. I think that's the point. It is hugely advantageous to the person in power now, but it is not disadvantageous to have the rule of law.
And yet, referencing our conversation with Izzah this morning, and yet, even when we talked about the possible outlawing of government ownership of media entities in the country, she, I think, sidestepped the notion and said, put it to the possible select committee, even for discussion, you know, obviously not within her own realm of influence. So, again, I mean, I think ideologically it's nice to have, but realistically and practically not so possible. What's your sense?
Well, you know, ownership of the press, this happens all over the world. Perhaps not as directly as it happens here. But you have media who side one party or the other. Now, what you need is access to both. What you need is for them to also report on the opposition, what the opposition's position is. And as long as you have a fair media, I think that's good. But I agree with you. I think you need to look at the question of ownership as well. How much you can control that is something you'll have to...
Is it too ideological to wish for perhaps an engineered sell-down of government ownership of media entities? I mean, for example, The Star is 42.6% owned by the MCA. Utusan is 49.8% owned by AMNO. And there's a whole raft of others that are compromised in what some way, shape or form by political ownership.
Yes, I think that has always been the problem. But you know what? I'm not sure that you can necessarily stop it. But if you have a free and fair media and a media council, then that is looking at that, and everybody has a fair crack at the ownership and as well as the media, then that is something that should even out, because you will get press that sides one side or the other, whatever the question of ownership is. But look what's happening now, despite the question of ownership, what's happening now? Because they know it is opening up. That don't forget, there are journalists in those organizations that want to write freely, that want to write independently, and that's what we should encourage. But I take your point on the sell down of the in relation to political parties.
Well, what about the one of the first hiccups for the Pakatan Harapan government was the statement made by Tun that they would not be repealing the anti-fake news law, but they would be revising it, strengthening it, making it a better law. There have been quite a bit of pushback from the activist community, those saying that in fact there's no justification for an anti-fake news law. Do you see a shifting in positions with the Pakatan Harapan government? Do they not quite understand themselves, Tun included, understand the implications of the anti-fake news legislation?
I think, let me tell you my position. It has to be repealed in total. There's absolutely no basis for it. We know the circumstances in which it was passed. We have no reason to have a fake news bill, anti-fake news bill. There'll have to be a discussion on that. I think once the relevant committees are set up on review of existing laws that have to be repealed, then anti-fake news will probably be first on the list.
But that reminds you and us and the Gayathri of the CRJ from yesterday's discussion as well. But I just want to return to the point, Ambika, if possible, about how if the Bar Council gets its wishes and you are made Attorney General, I mean, in one fell swoop, someone of your independence, possibly, and your experience, as well as even the whole issue of gender diversity and minority representation in a position of influence as well, how would you go about if that reality were to transpire? How would you go about repealing the Fake News Act, the Sedition Act, and other deleterious legislation?
Well, it'll have to be a strong recommendation from the AG's chambers, because ultimately repealing of the Act goes to Parliament, and that's where it'll have to happen. But I think, you see, this is where the role of the Attorney General is critical, because the Attorney General must advise the government of the day about legislation that ought to be repealed and that undermines the rule of law. And the government of the day must give credence to that kind of advice that is given by the Attorney General. But they have already made statements that they're going to look at these oppressive laws. They've been talking about these oppressive laws for a long, long time. So I would be very surprised if that is not one of the first things on their agenda. And I honestly think that's what they will do.
Well, we're speaking to Dato' Ambika Srinivasan, lawyer and former chairperson of Berse, the electoral reform movement. We'll be back with more. Tell us what you feel. You can tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, if you just joined us. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Kusu Chuang, and our guest on The Breakfast Grill this morning, Dato' Ambika Srinivasan, lawyer and former chairperson of Bersih, the electoral reform movement. Ambika, we were talking about the importance of impartiality of a non-political person in some of the key institutions of state. Now, we have a WhatsApp message from Ku, SK. He says, you, in fact, were partisan in the run-up to GE14. You took a very strong position in supporting the Pakatan Harapan parties or party coalition. Does it rule you out as somebody who's impartial?
Okay, here's the thing. I think it's a fair point to make, first of all. But as far as I was concerned, what I was rooting for was a change of government. And the only way that was going to happen is if Pakatan Harapan came into power. But nevertheless, I can understand it is true, I was going out on the campaign trail, as it were, supporting Pakatan Harapan. But personally, as far as I'm concerned, I would criticize Pakatan Harapan just as easily as I would criticize the Barisan Nasional, because for me, the nation comes first.
Are you a member of any political party?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, just on that point as well, Ambika, is it really, are we too idealistic to think that really the sea of change and this whole notion of freedom and liberty has really descended upon the country for us to hope that, you know, this new era of scrutiny and oversight and governance is really very much a reality in Malaysia after 61 years of essentially, single dimension?
Okay, I'll tell you why I think it is. We now have a democracy because for the first time we have changed government. That means the government is well aware that the people have the power to remove them if they do not keep up with their promises or if they do not come through on key issues. We've had 60 over years, okay, of concentration of power. That needs to change immediately. For example, one of the things that they have promised they will do is to bring in limited term of the Prime Minister. That is a must. So we need to see these changes come in quickly. And I think for me, because we were able to change the government the last time, we can change it again. And I think the current government knows that and they should know that. And so I think I'm very positive about the future.
What about the question of, and just not about the future, but the past? Because a lot of things happened under the Barisan Nasional government at the federal level for all those decades that we mentioned. And we have a question from Kala. He says, on investigating past corruption cases, how far back should we go before we move forward?
I mean, that's a good question. A lot of people have been asking that. You see, I think that it is time for us to, we have to pick up key cases, all right, critical cases, and we need to deal with that openly and people have to face the full force of the law. But there are, other cases that we may have to look at a sort of an amnesty type of a program, because we don't want to be spending our entire time just prosecuting. Because if you had to prosecute every single act of corruption or whatever it is, there are just not enough prosecutors. So we may have to look at a program, an amnesty type of program.
Well, in certain cases, I guess, where financial distress has been suffered, I mean, for example, with Felda and Mara and 1MDB and even, SRC potentially, then those are easily ascertained. But what about other transgressions where they might not be so quantifiable? This whole issue of amnesty, from a process perspective, how will it unfold?
Well, an amnesty can come in many different forms. For example, and it's a little bit like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission idea, okay? Because that actually allows you to reconcile with what has happened in the past. But amnesty, for example, I'll give you one possible scenario, which is that those who confess, all right, to transgressions, There could be an arrangement that there's no prosecution, provided they pay back X percent of what has been lost.
Reparation. Okay.
Those kinds of things. I mean, these are just suggestions. It's not easy to work out the details, but it's just a possibility. Yeah.
And one of the, on the front page of the same paper I referred to earlier, The Sun, MACC Chief Commissioner Tan Sri Zulkifli Ahmad resigns, it says. And of course, there have been suggestions to bring back Tan Sri Abu Qasim, the former MACC chief. I believe he's declined. He said he will help out. But I believe also that the family of Teo Beng Huat, who died under mysterious circumstances, said they don't want Abu Qasim back. Now, what do we do with a situation like that? What do we do with cases of potentially of murder that might have happened during the previous administrations?
Oh, those are cases that can be reopened, you know, because don't forget, in Teo Beng Hock's case, the Court of Appeal actually, that was the last decision on record, actually found that this was not a case of suicide. So it's crying for reopening. So those are one of the cases I would say should be reopened.
Well, you know, talking about this whole issue of the talent pool, because whether it's the MACC or whether it's the Attorney General, does Malaysia have the available talent pool to repopulate these key institutions, as you mentioned?
We do, actually. And I think it's time we gave fresh blood a chance. It's time that we thought carefully about who should head these institutions.
Well, let's get into your head if we can, Ambika. Who do you think would be best equipped to, you know, head the MACC or the Attorney General's position or even the, you know, other big ministries?
Well, I'm not going to name names because I don't think it's proper. And I think all I can say is I am convinced that there are more than enough people who can do the job.
Okay, I want to ask this question from one of our listeners, because this person is asking, what are the key criteria to fill the Attorney General's position?
Well, integrity to start with, independence, and courage, because it must be someone who's prepared to tell the government they're wrong when they are, and who will advise the government if they are transgressing the law. And that's the kind of Attorney General that I would look forward to.
Now, we're in a period, I guess, of transition, and there are many things that are happening and on many different levels, including the question of consolidating the power and stability of the Pakatan Harapan government. One of the things that we noted, and Muniandi has a question, it has to do with Sarawak and the meeting between Tun Dr. Mahathir and Tahir Mahmud, the former chief minister, now governor of Sarawak. They say people are concerned that what's going to be happening there is that Taib's alleged crimes are going to be erased or papered over, not dealt with under this current administration. Are you concerned about Taib? Because he is a big name in terms of the corruption story in Malaysia.
Oh, yes, I am concerned about Taib. I think there's enough out there and evidence, not just here, but overseas.
But what about the political reality for this government? Do you think, and also maybe the long-standing relationship, personal relationship between Tun and Tahir Mahmud, do you think they will actually have the political will to move against Tahir?
They must have the political will to move against Tahir, otherwise they're no different from the previous government. So yes, I do have concerns about that. If you're going on an agenda of the rule of law, then it applies to everyone. No exception.
Talking about the rule of law, there are some grey areas, and I want to cite this whole issue of in legal circles is called contract sanctity. And you know, going back through the 90s, and you know, Deutsche Telekom and Cellcom, these were those issues then. This whole issue that the Pakatan Harapan government wants to relook at the contracts, these agreements and these pacts that have been signed with Chinese consortium, whether it's on the East Coast Rail Link or whether it's on the GEMAS double tracking electrified railway, even the Penang Tunnel Bridge project. I mean, these are contracts which have been signed by the government and the various consortia of China. How, from a legal standpoint, should these issues be addressed when it comes to revising or reviewing these contracts from a contract sanctity perspective?
Well, that's one of the first things they should do, by the way, in my view, is review contracts, not just the China contracts, but even Malaysian contracts that and licenses, etc., which are against the national or public interest.
Is that a get-out-of-jail card?
No. What they must do is they must review and renegotiate if they have to. You see, we don't know what these contracts say, and that's one of the things that is a problem. But they can renegotiate. And you can even pass legislation if necessary, not necessarily in relation to all contracts, to allow the government to do that, to review. But we must also have in mind that we have to ensure that we do not lose we don't want people to lose faith in our government entering into contracts and then being able to sidestep it. But if it is against a national interest, we must renegotiate them.
Does legislation exist to allow, you know, national interest to be uppermost in the minds of the counterparties to these agreements if they want to be reviewed?
There's no legislation now in relation
so
to that.
So can you get out of these?
Yes, contracts can always be renegotiated.
Now, this turned out to be another question. This is from Santosh. He's asked about Rafizi Ramli from PKR and his statement in relation to the cabinet formation of cabinet and the announcement of it. I believe you did weigh in publicly on his, some people call it an outburst. Others will say he was speaking truth to power. What's your take on the Rafizi Ramli controversy?
Okay, I mean, for me, I think one of the problems is there is a difficulty for some people in the transition from being opposition to government. You cannot behave as you did in when you were in opposition when you are in government. There are, for me, issues of collective responsibility, for example. You could see Tun Mahathir, when he was sworn in, he took an oath of secrecy. So those members of cabinet, etc., will have to do the same thing. And there are reasons for that. There are reasons for that, because otherwise you might as well have cabinet meetings in the Selangor Padang and televise it. I mean, there are reasons why there must be a level of secrecy. I'm not talking about not being accountable, but in the negotiations or in the discussions, there must be a level of secrecy. So for me, this is about that. We don't want to know about your having 47 seats and therefore you have to have more and all that. The public shouldn't have to deal with that issue. You need to deal with it behind closed doors and you need to resolve it behind closed doors.
But what people are saying, though, that if we do not allow Rafizi the space to make his criticisms, we're basically pushing the country back into a time where everybody conformed, and you know, and that there would be BN 2.0.
You know, who says he doesn't have the right to speak up? But where do you speak up? That's the point. Do you straight away go to the media on every decision that you disagree with? That we will be sitting here and actually getting involved in all decision-making which ought to be done in a consensual manner.
We're coming up to the news bulletin. Stay with us, because Dato Ambika Srinivasan is not going anywhere anytime soon. She, of course, needs no introduction, but she is a lawyer and a former chairperson of BERSE, the Electoral Reform Movement. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning and welcome back to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Kusu Chuang, and our guest this morning, Dato Ambika Srinivasan, lawyer and, of course, former chairperson of BERSE, the Electoral Reform Movement. I want to begin, Ambika, with the issue of Tun Dr. Mahathir. He's now central to the Malaysian story of democratization. When in the previous incarnation, he was central to the story of authoritarian rule. If you remember, just a couple of years ago, there were people, activists, saying they didn't want to give him a voice at BERSE rallies. After that, they didn't want him and his political formation to be part of the Pakatan Rakyat formation. What's changed, and how do you view that that transformation of Tun's role in democratization?
Well, you know, I spent such a good part of my life fighting Tun Mahathir and all that happened. I mean, that past, there has to be some reconciliation about that past, because a lot of people were hurt. But what I will tell you is this. As far as I'm concerned, the main reason these elections were won is because of Tun Mahathir. And I can tell you this, in my interactions with Tun Mahathir. He listens. He listens before he comments. So if you have a meeting, he actually hears everyone's views before he gives his own. And I think because he has had to fight the system, the authoritarian system that was in place, there is a realization, and no doubt in my mind, that certain changes have to be made, that he must have come to that realization. And he realized, I think he talks about the rule of law all the time. And I think that is the positive change. And I tell you what he brought to the table. He brought focus. He is extremely disciplined. In fact, there's a lovely Lat cartoon, I think, or a cartoon after the elections where he's there with a loud hailer saying, all right, everyone, get back to work, you know. That is Tun Mahathir. And I think that's what he brought to the table. He brought focus to the leadership of Pakatan Harapan at a very, very critical time. And you must remember that a lot of people on the ground, from the Mahathir era, as it were, trust Mahathir, as well as Tan Sri Muhyiddin and all of those from UMNO. So that helped in bringing the numbers across. So for me, actually, it's a journey for all of us. And I think what's important is that we need everyone to come on board on this journey towards reform. And I think we are headed that way. So, I mean, I don't know whether that's I've answered the question, but I think that we will have to keep them accountable.
Well, those of us who are old enough remember in 1987 and the whole issue of the removal of the Lord President of the judiciary, May Day for Justice, I think,
yes.
Engineered by, of course, the good doctor. You know, I do therefore now, Ambika, say that the possibility of the, you know, the whole issue of leopards not changing their spots, the whole notion is can be completely dismissed based on what you just said.
I'm not saying we should dismiss anything. That's why I say there must always be a reconciliation with the past. But right now, time-wise, the future comes first. And what I'm seeing is that there is a real political will from what Tun Mahathir says. And I don't just judge him by what he says. I judge him by what he does. You look at the way he takes questions. He's not afraid of the press. So for the, you know, the last prime minister wouldn't answer questions most of the time. But here, he's constantly engaging with the press, engaging with the public. We know what he's up to. We know what he's thinking. It's a good start. Let me just put it that way.
Okay, on the question of what he does as opposed to what he said there would be no purges. But there are concerns in some circles, and there's a tweet here asking you about UMNO's potential deregistration, saying that how this can impact the development democracy in this country. Are you watching that space? And what do you think about this, the potential of a deregistered UMNO?
I mean, for me, that is an issue that has to go through the courts. We must respect due process. I think what I wouldn't like to see is, you know, the Registrar of Societies perhaps being used in that process. We need a strong opposition as much as we need a good government. So whatever happens legally to UMNO, I think due process must be followed. But at the end of the day, in whichever form they are, a good opposition is as important as a good government. And I hope we will not have this nonsense that we had previously, you know, where the opposition is treated as the enemy. Because don't forget, people voted them in. You must respect the views of the voters who voted him in. And I'm hoping that this government will show that it is a government for all, including UMNO members, including all the members. And all the rakyat. And that's what they must aim for. They are a government for everyone.
Well, speaking about due process and the rule of law, Guan Eng, the former chief minister of Penang, now, soon to be minister of finance, not sworn in yet. He's, of course, also labouring under a charge of, corruption in Penang. How would you reconcile this, given what you just said, in terms of the rule of law?
Oh, I think that has to be resolved through the courts. I mean, the process has started. So that is something, I mean, in my view, that reeked of being a political prosecution. In that sense, you cannot disqualify people who have been put under the microscope for being opposition. Nevertheless, the process has started. The process has started, and that should complete, and that process should complete.
Well, speaking of process, we of course had the conclusion of the general election. There might be election petitions for people who feel that the process were not adhered to, or in fact there was unfairness, or maybe even cheating. Do you think that going forward we need to scrutinize these results? And are we in danger of undermining the current government by doing that?
The only way you can challenge election results is through by way of an election petition by a particular candidate. And there are others, but basically by the candidate. So there is, you know, it really depends on what happens and how many petitions are filed and so on. I would imagine only the losing parties would file an election petition. So I don't see any danger of the results being upset. In fact, I know for a fact that there were proceedings in court in relation to the last elections declare the results null and void, but that was thrown out. And the court said you have to go via an election petition before you can do anything. That doesn't mean that we do not examine the Election Commission and their conduct. That's a different issue altogether. And I think the way in which Malaysian voters were treated in the last election must have been the most despicable, actually, display of bias that I have seen in a long time. I think this must be one of the worst that we have seen.
Though the Elections Commissioner has come out to say that the results, the fact that the results went for Pakatan Harapan is proof that in fact the system is fair and unbiased.
Well, I'd say that happened despite the Election Commission, because and it was people power that did it, and that's why this is so important. Not just here, but we are now praised in the region, okay, as proving that people can still bring change despite a flawed ballot box, despite a flawed election.
And maybe that could be the subject of our and follow-up question after this break. We'll look at the decision of PAS to leave the Pakatan Rakyat. What do you think it means for the country as a whole? They have two states in Kelantan and Terengganu. They played, potentially, almost played kingmaker role in Kedah and Perak. All these questions coming up. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, and thank you so much for staying with us. This is The Breakfast Grill. Our guest, Dato' Ambika Srinivasan, former chairperson of Bursay 2.0. Also, potentially, I mean, if some people in civil society get their way, the next Attorney General or chairperson of the Elections Commission or head of MECC, any number of positions. But before, that time will tell. Ambika, you were a very strong strategist, very public in your views about where the democratic movement and also the political formations that around it should go. The question of PAS leaving, of course, the PAS Pinter Amanah is still there. They're in the frame. Mat Sabu is now Minister of Defence. It's a very good moment for them as a political party. But two states went to PAS. They have a very different vision of the country, and they now perhaps believe very strongly that their kingmaker strategy, their forcing of three-corner fights, was right.
Well, I mean, we've got freedom of speech, right? So I can say exactly as I think. I think PAS let us down in the last election, and the reason is that they came into power, and I remember people asking me when I said, look, you must vote for PAS. This was the last election. And they said, are you sure that's okay? And I said, of course we can trust them. You know, that was the thing. So then when they break away after that and they move to UMNO, or Barisan Nasional, the very parties that we voted against, I feel that there was, that was wrong. That was very wrong, because that was, in a sense, many voters felt betrayed by that. And then not just that, where they deliberately stood so as to spoil, so as to be spoiler. That again, I mean, it's their right, I'm not saying no, but that again was very disappointing to a lot of voters. But having said all of that, you don't discount PAS. They have a huge following. A following, actually, who stood with us, by the way, shoulder to shoulder in many Bursay rallies, okay? And we made so many friends amongst the PAS members. So we don't discount them. You may not agree with the leadership, but there are many PAS members that we can work with. And as I say, we must bring them on this journey towards reform. We cannot stand apart, and we cannot treat them as people who don't matter. they do matter, and they must come with us on this journey towards reform.
And against all polls, they strengthened their position in Kelantan and Terengganu against all expectations. Do you think it was basically it was a result of a repudiation of the BN government, or is it because you felt that there was a groundswell of support for what they stood for, despite all those troubles that you know that you just described?
Well, partly I think it was because there were, people saying, look, PAS is going to be wiped out in this election, etc. When you do that, then you rally the PAS supporters in favour of their own party, because that's the last thing they would want to see. So it's partly that. It's partly that they're the loyalty to the party. And you see a lot of that amongst PAS members, no matter what they feel. Their loyalty is first to the party. So we need to understand all these dynamics. We can't treat everybody as the same and say, oh, they're not democratic. Or the. We need to understand the mindset and we need to work with them.
Ambika, you know, last question for you. We're running out of time. A lot of people are anxious. People are delirious on one hand, but they're also anxious and very jumpy. You know, news does make them, move this way or that way, or they're forwarding stuff. What's your advice to people now as they watch this government coming into formation?
Well, I would say we have to exercise a little bit of patience, maybe not a lot, because everybody wants to see immediate change. But these things take time. Processes have to be followed. We don't want to see mob rule, for example. But I can see a lot of venting on Twitter against the former government and various people. People will vent. But at some point, that should cease. That shouldn't be our focus. Revenge cannot be our focus. We must just allow the due process to take its course. What we must do is now look at how to rebuild this nation. And no doubt, mistakes will be made by this government. And we should be there to assist, and we should be there to tell them what those mistakes are. So as far as I'm concerned, we are on the right track. It's only been 2 days, don't forget. And already everybody is saying, we want X, we want Y, we want Z. Well, all that is very good. But it will take time. But, you know, the new government also has to realize the anxiety of the people to see immediate change, because we've suffered for so long, right? So you can't blame them, really, you know. But what I don't like to see is, as I say, even the former prime minister deserves a defense. So we must allow that legal process. If you believe in the rule of law, it must be there for everyone.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking to Dato Ambika Srinivasan, a lawyer and, of course, chairman of Bersih. We'll be back with some business news. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.